Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term socialism and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities and a focus on social investment, could be a force for good in all of our lives. Dan, what's up?
Pat, it's season two. You know what's funny? I feel exactly as I felt in season one. Is there anything different?
There are a couple differences. Dito, why don't you jump in here and tell us what you're going to bring to the table for the TDS podcast?
All right, absolutely. How's it going, everybody? I'm Dito22. I'm a music producer, recording engineer, and I've known Pat and Dan now for a good solid 2 months. And hope I can help add some just normal guy perspective and clean up the audio on this bad boy and make it sound like a good podcast, because you guys got a definite good thing going, and I'm happy to join.
And a longtime friend of mine, Carlos, is also joining the team. Carlos, why don't you tell us what you can bring to the table as well?
Hey, what's going on, guys? Carlos here, also known as Arc5. It's my new DJ name. But yeah, I mean, I'm coming at this wearing a couple hats. Not only am I, DJ by night / turntablist by night at night, I'm also I work in the life sciences field as a scientist at a large biopharmaceutical company. I'm a big data guy, so I love stats, I love data, so I also hope to add that perspective when we're talking about, you know, statistics or anything that has to do with sort of numbers, providing some analysis and some perspective on those kinds of topics, but also helping the crew here, Dan and Pat, sourcing some really good guests on the communication side. I'm really happy to help on that front as well, but definitely happy to be part of this crew now, and I'm looking forward to an awesome second season.
Absolutely.
Welcome aboard, guys. I just have to warn you, this ship, it hits some rough waters at times, but we've never capsized.
Excellent. I'm a good swimmer.
Pretty close.
We're like the United States. It's like, you know, a hot mess, and we, you know, we stagger to the finish and we pass out. We wake up the next day and try again.
There you go.
Perfect. So let's start off with our first topic here. At this point, it's feeling like it's not as urgent of a concern, but for a little while there, it looked like Kanye was running for president, actually. And Dito, you've been producing music for over 20 years. What are your thoughts on Kanye, first as a producer, and then in terms of like what was going on with that situation?
Okay, so first a warning. When it comes to music and music taste and hip hop as a culture and art form, I am highly opinionated, so that take that warning with a grain of salt and do with it what you will. I am actually not a huge fan of Kanye from a production aspect. Is he talented? Yes. Talent is not always something that you can deny, even if you don't appreciate the output. So there's that. As far as him running for president, I truly believe, I know we talked about this off air before we started. I truly believe that was a legitimate effort to try to capture that, that run. It did scare the crap out of me when he did it, because I tried to foresee the potential play out there, and I don't think it would have gone, in my favor, at least of how I would want the election to fall. So I'm maybe not too thrilled with, or I feel sorry with the way it's kind of fizzled out with what he seems to be having a very personal, troubling episode, if you will. But I am glad that it may not get in the way of the election coming up.
So Carlos, you mentioned that you're a science guy, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So what would you attribute the recent spike in COVID numbers to? And they do seem to sort of be localized in certain communities as opposed to others. Is it the population? Is it the wearing of the masks? Like, what do you think are some of the key reasons for the spread?
Yeah, so you don't really have to wear a science hat to do this analysis, to be honest. The recent spike, in my opinion, is not necessarily due to any sort of scientific or any epidemiologic sort of phenomenon. It's been more of a political reason as to why the spike has, you know, happened. It's governors falling in line with, you know, with Trump, Republican governors falling in line with Trump, in my opinion, not following the guidance that, you know, Trump's own administration has put forth mm-hmm. through the CDC. And that has a trickle down effect, right? I mean, because you have the population within any, you know, respective state, not following the guidance or just not being given guidance, and not only just guidance, but also, you know, the laws to give the guidance some teeth. It's kind of a problem, and I think it's sort of a really nasty trickle down effect, and it all comes from the top. The top ranks in government, i.e. the president of the United States. So I think it has a lot to do with that. But also, you know, the virus is what it is, and it's going to do what it's going to do, and it's going to infect. And if we give it the opportunity to infect, it will absolutely take that opportunity.
Right, right. And I actually, it's interesting. You're talking about it from like sort of a political perspective, and definitely there are many good scientists out there. I look at it. I studied finance in college. I look at it from like an economic perspective. I think a lot of these Southern politicians see the virus and the economy as sort of like two battle bots fighting it out and to see who's going to win. And I don't know if they see the connection between stable testing numbers, the spread of the virus, and then economic activity. Like, I don't know. I think they could benefit from like some freshman economics, because they're going to be in a state of constant open and close for the next. Because remember, down south, it doesn't, you know, I don't know if you guys knew this, but they don't get snow. So I'm pretty sure they're going to be outdoors indefinitely. They're going to be going to the beach all winter long.
Yep.
Yeah. And I don't see.
There's definitely that the economic component in that, you know, that plays into the decision to either open up the state or open up the economy. It really is a balancing act. But as you know, I've heard many governors say, the governors that are on the right side of this, you can't have a stable and a good economy if you don't have a healthy population in your state. It's exactly 100%. It's a back and forth, right? It's just, you know, the seesaw effect where we're seeing, you know, you want to open up, but you want to be healthy. And they're trying to play on, you know, both sides of that, and it's not working out. But on the economic front, you absolutely have, you know, you have to temper your enthusiasm and your willingness to want to open up your economy with keeping everybody safe and healthy, because if they're not, it's just going to collapse the economy yet again.
Good. So also in recent weeks, we've had two big wins for indigenous groups in the United States. First, we have Justice Kavanaugh, of all people. I was personally shocked when I found out that he wrote the decision. Basically, the decision promised, went in on the side of Native Americans and basically honored the treaties that were signed by the United States hundreds of years ago and granted half of Oklahoma basically to Native groups. Now the second win is a long time coming, and we can talk about whether corporations pushed Dan Snyder over the edge here, but the Washington DC football team, which Dito, I hear that you're a fan of, is finally changing its name. What do you think of the fact that the team has finally lost the racist slur of a team name that it has?
I think it's great that they finally did it, and it should have been done a long time ago. I was very young when a older family member got me into football, and that was his team of choice. He was from the DC area. So I fell in love with that team because that was the team that I had to like. And immediately, even as a child, I think I was 11, 10 or 11. And I knew that name had that negative connotations to it. And knew that it should change. I'm definitely glad to see that it happened, and I'm actually ashamed that it took as long as it did, but you know, can't be upset with the fact that they're finally doing it.
So Pat, I heard, that it's according to the commander in chief, who is, you know, directing a pandemic and planning for an election and, organizing schools for the entire country. He mentioned that it's completely safe to return to school, but not safe to host an election. Your thoughts?
Yeah, so I think he kind of set the world on fire with that tweet. I think there was a lot of concern. But then anyone with an understanding of the Constitution weighed in and explained that in fact is Congress's responsibility. And so Trump himself does not have the ability to put off the election. Now, the school issue, I don't know of very many people who feel safe, even in a state like Massachusetts, sending their kids back to school, especially for Dan, you and I working in a big district like we do. I also recently saw a poll of Boston Teachers Union members, and it was basically 3/4 of union members said that they would not feel comfortable returning to the school building. So a lot remains to be seen what's going to happen here in the Northeast when schools start, you know, in September. Some schools are starting up around the country right now. But I think that they're going to see some spikes in numbers that coincide with those returning to school. But we'll see on that front. I mean, I think that's a huge question mark for everybody this fall.
Can I ask a question about that?
Sure.
So refresh my memory. What age groups do you guys teach?
Middle school. So 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. But
all right. So has your school district given you the ability to weigh in as the teachers to weigh in on how you're feeling about it? Because I know as a parent I'm a parent of kids in 2 different school districts, so I get those surveys left and right, and every time they update it, I answer the survey again with how I feel as a parent. So have they given you that opportunity to voice your concerns there as a teacher?
Yes.
Yeah. And our principal sent out a survey to our staff, which I thought was really smart as well.
Excellent.
I think where it gets really tricky, Dito, is that, like I live in a small suburb outside of Boston, and, they're having webinars, and they're getting, you know, everyone's feedback, and they're, you know, being cautious, right, and talking about starting virtual and then rolling out some in-person in October. But we're talking about my entire district, maybe 2,500 kids. When you get the scale of Boston, right, which is 53,000, and then look at New York. New York has over 1 million school kids. There's too many variables. So let's say that in New York, let's say de Blasio is ready, the union is ready, the parents are ready, which is not true. None of that's true. But let's just say for the sake of argument, right? Let's say they even have 20% of staff that say, we're not coming in. Use my sick time. A lot of teachers have several hundred hours of sick time. You can't run 1,000 school district. There's over 1,000 schools in New York at 80% of capacity, because if anything, a lot of these plans are calling for a 50% reduction in students so that they can be 6 feet apart. So you actually need more staff to run it. So it's kind of an academic conversation, because we can say like, oh, you know, the politician said we're ready to go and the union says we're ready to go. If more than four, I don't know, Pat, what do you think? 3 or 4 teachers per building are out, it doesn't work.
Right. No, you
might be able to hoof it at each grade level down one teacher. Maybe, and that's in middle school. In elementary, if your first grade teacher is out, I don't know what you do.
Well,
they're the only teacher.
We also need more money in a district like ours that's cash strapped. We're going to need much more money, infused into the system in order to even make the changes that are recommended, like the plexiglass dividers, and all the we don't even have clean drinking water that comes out of the tap. Every Boston Public School has a sign on the wall that says this water should be used for hand washing only. Like, that's the type of thing that, facilities-wise, you can imagine if that's a sign in the bathroom, right. Imagine what the ventilation is like in that building, right?
Exactly.
So that those are the concerns there, and I think we'll continue to monitor this. On the podcast, we'll talk about, whether or not we're starting back up and stuff like that. And I think it's really great to have you two, Carlos and Dito, involved in the conversation. But let's go ahead and set up our episode here. We've got a few great interviews. We're going to be talking about the upcoming eviction crisis and the fact that 25 to 30 million people will be out of housing if something isn't done and something drastic isn't done. So we've got Will, who is the director of Fair Housing, Civil Rights and Equity, and he for the mayor of Boston. He discusses the upcoming eviction crisis and also what his office does to make sure that tenants who want to use vouchers are not discriminated against. We've got one of my former students, Francesca. She's using a pseudonym here because of the personal nature of what she discusses, but she discusses her family's struggles with homelessness when she was a kid, and she's now a successful college student. And lastly, we've got Tim Scalona, who's a graduate student at UMass Amherst. He's written a couple of great op-eds for the Boston Globe, and he discusses his family's personal struggles with homelessness and a bunch of really smart policies that the state and federal government could adopt to avoid this crisis.
Excellent.
That's all you could get for this episode, Pat?
just a couple interviews? I'd like to go on record saying that I know Los knows Will pretty personally. I've met Will, and I'm pretty sure we could both agree that he is a stand-up gentleman.
Yeah. He's a great guy, and he knows his stuff, too.
Hey, thank you for having me, Pat. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Last time I saw you, you were pouring a cooler full of ice water over Carlos's head. He's a new member of the TDS podcast team. I think it was for the ice bucket challenge, but it could have been because Los was running his mouth a little bit. But you really dumped that on him. He was drenched.
That's exactly it. It was for the ALS challenge, which was a really fun challenge and a really good way to raise awareness for ALS. And Carlos was talking about, so I had to pour some water on.
So that was, I can still see the image in my mind, actually, to be honest. So folks, Will is the executive director of Housing, Equity, and Civil Rights for the City of Boston. Will, could you explain to our listeners what your office does?
So my office is the Office of Fair Housing and Equity for the City of Boston. I am the executive director. And what my office does is we investigate housing discrimination cases, and we enforce the Fair Housing Act and fair housing law. And so how that pretty much works is that in the state of Massachusetts, there are 14 protected classes. And just to rattle off a few, you can't discriminate against someone based on race, sex, gender, family status, economic status, military status, religion, color, age, disability, and that's just to name a few. But there are 14 protected classes in the state of Massachusetts. And what we do is anyone who falls into this category that feels like they've been discriminated against, my office investigates the complaint and also seeks enforcement against the respondent, meaning the person, whether it's a landlord, bank, lender, property owner, real estate broker that engage in this practice, we seek enforcement against them if there is a probable cause finding. And when there is a probable cause finding, the commission can sanction an individual, a bank, an entity, property owners up to $25,000. Several times in the process before we get there, we try to conciliate, which means we bring both parties together and try to reach some kind of amicable resolution that makes the person or the persons who fall into the protected class whole for the discriminatory practice that has occurred. And then the second thing we do is we also make sure that whomever engaged in it also goes to training, fair housing training, either with our office or MCAD, which is the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination, where they take fair housing training courses so they can understand whatever it is that they did, the laws around fair housing, why they cannot discriminate, and also we even require them to do something else. And again, this is for the public interest, right? Because it's one thing to sanction you or bring out enforcement against someone, but it doesn't mean that you're going to be a bad actor. So we want to make sure that not only do we deal with it, but we also teach you the fair housing law so you do not engage in these practices ever again.
Yeah, that sounds like a great program, so that you're not just, you know, punishing someone, you're also making sure that they have all the education they need to practice whatever they do fairly. So I noticed on boston.gov, which is the City of Boston website, that there are a lot of resources up there for tenants. And I saw mention of an eviction task force. Is that task force connected to your office? And are they ramping up to get ready for, you know, the end to the eviction moratorium in Massachusetts?
Yes and no. No, that task force is not connected to my office specifically, but a lot of the sister agencies who are a part of that task force, I work with them. We have a great partnership. So we're all engaged in this work, but the folks on that task force are specifically people who have more control, if you will, over the issue of discrimination than the issue of eviction than my particular office does. I get involved when there is a fair housing case that involves evictions, but what this task force is trying to do is make sure that they do whatever they can to work with the city and landlords and voucher holders to keep people in their homes. As you know, we are in a very, very serious pandemic. And the only thing that matters to us, or the number one concern for us, is life, the preservation of life. And making sure that people don't get evicted at this time is super crucial because, one, you know, if people get evicted, that means they're going to be on the street, right? We also know, in fairness, there's about 52 million Americans, as we know as of yet, who are now unemployed because of this pandemic. So it has a huge trickle-down effect. And by keeping people in their homes, you keep them safe. If not, it's about the preservation of life.
Yeah, and I think that gets me into my next question here, which is, like, from your vantage point, you know, where does the city stand on preventing evictions? I know that the state has a eviction moratorium, and that moratorium runs up in the middle of August. And I can imagine the mayor and everyone in your office is wanting to prevent as many evictions as possible for that preservation of life that you mentioned. But this feels super urgent. Where do you think the city stands in getting ready for, you know, the coming wave of eviction proceedings?
So the city stands at the place where we don't want, the mayor is adamant about this issue. One of the things he has done, I believe it was last week or the week prior, he has extended for public housing, like, for example, the Boston Housing Authority, which is one of the voucher holders in the city of Boston. And also, it's also a place that houses a lot of low-income families throughout the city of Boston. They've extended the no eviction in public housing to the end of this year.
Okay.
the state has its own where it can, the state can make sure, or they can see to it that the moratorium on evictions go for both public and private. And it'll be, I think right now they've extended it into October, if I'm not mistaken, or September, one of the two. And forgive me for not knowing right off the top, because it recently just happened.
Okay.
So it's been extended beyond August a little bit, but there is legislation, from what I understand, at the state house to extend it even longer.
Okay, good.
Yep. Yep.
And for the, you said for public housing, that's already been extended to the end of the year?
Yes, to the end of the year.
Okay, good. So when I worked as a housing advocate in Framingham, I saw a lot of discrimination that tenants experienced, especially tenants who were trying to rent using a voucher. And just to explain to listeners who might not be familiar with voucher rentals, vouchers are programs that pay a substantial portion of the monthly rent for tenants who are low income so that the tenant can afford an apartment. Now, they're generally federally or state issued. I know that your office really takes this head on, but what do you see in terms of discrimination towards renters who are seeking to use a voucher? And why do you think landlords do this? Why do they discriminate against voucher holders?
Well, thank you, Pat. That's a really good question. And I the short answer to that question is racism. The reason why landlords, I believe, discriminate against voucher holders is because there's this idea of, we don't want those people. And by those people, you're talking about Black and brown people. They don't want them living next to them. And because they usually, well, all or most voucher holders are low income, you know, people who live in affluent neighborhoods or parts of the city, you know, don't want folks who are, just because they are of a lower economic status than them, living next to them. And again, like I said, the people who that affects the most are Black and brown people, period. You know, there's a very negative stigma that comes along with it. And what it does is it also helps to perpetuate segregation in the city of Boston. You know, there's a reason why certain neighborhoods are predominantly white, or you don't have a lot of Black or Latino families living in certain neighborhoods. And most of them seem to be congested in the Dorchester, Roxbury, Mattapan neighborhoods. You understand? This is a very wrong discriminatory practice that should never happen anywhere. You should have the right to live anywhere in the city of Boston that you want to live, in any neighborhood, regardless of your race, gender, creed, socioeconomic status. You know, none of that should matter, because that has nothing to do with just where you want to live. That it doesn't make you, you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Asinine practices that really are deeply rooted in just a racist practice that has befallen many folks who are in the African-American and Latino community.
Yeah, and from my experience, you know, my wife and I lived in Roslindale for quite a while, and it was a beautifully integrated community with, you know, folks of all different races in our neighborhood, and it just felt natural. It felt like it was enriching for every member of that community. So I definitely hear you on that. And you've already kind of answered my next question, which is kind of enforcement of against this discrimination. But I'd like you to go a little bit deeper. And if you have a housing management company or a landlord who violates this more than once, right? They've gone to the training, but they're still refusing tenants who are on vouchers. What does your office do next?
So that's a good question. So if we have a repeat, what we would call a frequent flyer or a repeat offender, each and every time the penalty gets stiffer and stiffer. And then what ends up happening is that that landlord, property owner, bank lender, whomever, they also get flagged with HUD. And HUD takes notice of them, and HUD even can come in and sanction them even further on top of what we have already done, right? And people who do this are put themselves at risk of serious litigation and serious financial penalties, because this is not something to, I mean, every time you violate a fair housing law, you're violating federal law. You understand? So our office, we're really an intermediary between the feds and the city of Boston, because we are the substantial equivalent of HUD, and those powers are given to us through HUD to investigate and enforce the fair housing law or any place where there is discrimination in housing. You know, so to answer your question, stiffer penalties come for such individuals. Much, much stiffer penalties come. And it, believe you me, I haven't seen many frequent flyers, because usually after the first or second time, the penalties are stiff enough that they don't want. And on top of that, our records are public information, right? So anyone from the public can have access to our records. And we are implementing some new methods and some new measures that's really going to deal with this issue, where soon we will be putting out a newsletter where we will actually highlight individuals who are engaging in this, in these discriminatory practices.
And yeah, so like a most wanted list of landlords and banks. Yeah.
Exactly. Most wanted list of people who do this, who discriminate, cases against them. You know, obviously we will always protect the identity of the complainant, but we would put these people out there. I mean, you could call it a public shaming tactic, but why shouldn't the public know about individuals? You know what I mean? Because this is not to cover it up. This is to bring light and shed light on a disgusting practice that at this stage, I can't even believe we're still going through it in 2020. But nevertheless, that's the world we live in, you know, and it's going to take a lot more. I mean, we've come a long way, but there's still so much more that needs to be done to really eradicate this disgusting practice that harms so many individuals out of our society.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. So I am really worried about the eviction crisis the entire country faces. And I know that your job forces you to focus your attention on the city of Boston. But if you were, you know, just to step back from that role and look at the nation as a whole, what do you think? You mentioned the number of unemployed individuals. I think the latest estimate I saw was at least 25 million individuals and families that could be evicted if evictions were allowed to go forward right now. What do you think needs to be done, and what could happen if all those folks are, you know, evicted from their homes?
I think the answer is very simple. I think that there needs to be a national moratorium, period. And I don't know exactly how you do that or how to make it work exactly. I'm sure there's methods, but there really, the simple answer is there should be a national moratorium on evictions, or state governors should really increase the moratoriums, right? Can you imagine 20 million families that are evicted? Just that thought alone is frightening.
Yeah, and it would be like Great Depression levels of homelessness. You know, there would be what were called Hoover camps at the time. It would be a nightmare with the pandemic, just awful.
Exactly. And what it really begs the question is, where is our humanity? Where is our compassion for people? You know, if we just strip off everything else and just deal with it at its most basic form, we're talking about compassion for people, compassion for humanity, people whom, not because of anything they did wrong, a crisis hit that pretty much buckled our economy. And because of that, they can't work. No fault of their own. They would love to get up every morning and go back to work and provide for their families. No one chooses just, you know, outrightly to become homeless.
Right. That's right.
And And because of something that they did not create, they now face the potential of being evicted. It's scary. It's the fact that we're even having this discussion is scary, because I would hope that our humanity would kick in at this point and say, wait a minute.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that gets me to my next point. And as a democratic socialist, you know, I have some views that people might consider radical or unrealistic, but I fundamentally believe that housing is a human right, that, you know, it should not be granted. It should be something that everyone has, just as a societal agreement, you know, as a social compact. Do you also share that belief? And I think, given your role, it'd be tough to do it otherwise. But do you agree that housing is a human right?
I absolutely believe that in my heart, in my soul, to my core, right? Because the thing about it is, housing is shelter. It's on the need. I think it's number two on hierarchy of needs that people right. need just to live and survive. You know, if you don't have shelter, you are open to so many different dangers. On so many different levels. So housing is a basic human right. It's a basic human need. I could tell more about you, believe it or not, than from your zip code, than anything your genes or your medical record can ever tell me. Right. Housing is a single determinant to education, to employment, to safety, and to a bunch of other things. You know, housing, just where you live determines all of that, right? Because where you live is going to determine the kind of education system you're next to. It's going to determine how safe you are, or the safety in your surroundings. It's going to determine your transportation. It's going to determine how or what jobs you can access and can't access. Those are all things that people don't realize that are built upon housing.
That's right. That's right. And I love the passion. And I really appreciate that you take this on day in and day out. You know, I'm super grateful that you took the time to come on the podcast. I want to thank you for sharing your voice and expertise. And, you know, I just love that you are going out there every day to fight for the vulnerable residents of Boston. I also hope that you'll consider coming back on the pod, potentially, you know, in the winter, to see where we are with stopping evictions, but also to see where your office is in terms of you know, stopping discrimination against tenants.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much, Will. It's really great to have you on.
Pat, I can't thank you enough. Thank you for having me on. You know, housing is a very passionate subject for me. There's no way I could do this job and not be passionate about it, because at the end of the day, it's about protecting people. And I would hate to think that the Fair Housing Act that was passed in 1968 didn't mean anything or has gone to waste. And never can that be the case, because when you're talking about protecting people's civil rights, when you're talking about protecting housing, you're really talking about protecting basic civil liberties, you know, and that's important, if not for anything else. And the one thing I will say before I go is that I think this pandemic has highlighted that, you know, for a long time we've heard, or people have always heard, that there's so many economic disparities that are happening to Black and Brown people. And, you know, I feel like at a point, maybe it was becoming like a broken record, but this pandemic, one of the things it has done is it has highlighted this issue to show how bad it really is, you know. A second thing is, I'm sure you saw the article from the Boston Globe that came out on July 1st regarding race and voucher discrimination. And since that article has come out, my office has been all over that issue, you know, because again, this wasn't something new. It's not something like when we saw it, it wasn't like this was shocking information. We know this has been happening in Boston, but now there is incriminating evidence to show that this is not a hoax. It's not something people are making up. It's none of those things, you know. It is, in fact, what it is.
Yeah, so it's an article by Megan Irons. It's the July 1st issue of the Boston Globe, and it includes a lot of details from a Suffolk University study that really laid bare the discrimination that still exists in Boston for housing for tenants of color, especially those who use vouchers. So, Will, I'll let you get back to your work in fighting discrimination and standing up for tenants in Boston, but I really appreciate you taking the time. Take care, man.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this. Thank you and have a great day.
You too. Welcome to Trickle Down Socialism, Francesca.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
This might be my proudest moment as a podcaster. Folks, this is one of my very brightest and hardest working students I've ever taught. She has chosen to use a pseudonym for this interview because of the personal nature of some of the questions that I'm going to ask. And she's currently going into her sophomore year at Suffolk University. She's just about the most pleasant person you'll ever hear on this podcast. So how'd your first year of college go, Francesca?
For me, it was a big change, but I have to say that keeping up with my grades and like a scholarly wise, it was really good. But I had a really hard time with making friends, feeling welcome. It was very hard for me, but my grades were really good. I actually ended up with a 4.0 GPA. I had all A's in my classes.
Nice work. Yes.
Thank you. But I was feeling left out. And right now I'm working in the process of like meeting new people. But my first year, it went well.
Great. I'm so proud. How's your family holding up through the pandemic? Everyone still healthy?
Everyone is healthy, yes. Everyone is doing well so far. Nobody has got COVID, thank God. But it has been so far a little difficult because my mom, she lost her job. At first, we didn't know about unemployment. And so my mom was not getting paid for about the first 3 weeks of the pandemic. And for her, it was very hard. It was very hard for us too. And then I was able to talk to you through email and to other people, and they informed me that I can do unemployment, and I was able to do that for her. And she was able to get some money. But then we just recently found out that her job, they closed down. So she's right now 100% unemployed until everything goes back to normal and she can find another job.
I'm sorry to hear that, but I've always been so impressed with how responsible you are and how quickly you take on family responsibilities to make sure that everything gets done. Your mom, you know, your whole family is lucky to have you. That's the truth.
Thank you.
So this week, our episode is going to focus on rental discrimination against Black and Brown voucher holders and the eviction crisis that kind of looms in the distance here. More than 25 million Americans are in a place where they could lose their apartments or their houses if the federal government doesn't work closely with state governments to continue extending what's known as a moratorium on evictions, basically when evictions can't proceed and they're stalled. So I know from helping you with some writing you did in my class that you've agreed that you're going to share a little bit about this with our listeners. But you and your family spent some time in homeless shelters when you were younger. How'd you end up in that situation?
Yes. So my family and I immigrated to the U.S. when I was only 10, and my brothers were still minors, and we were just very new to everything. It was like a new world for us. At some point, I had in my mind that it was going to feel like home once we arrived and everything was going to be perfect. But it was not like I expected. I was living in my grandma's house, and it was a one-bedroom apartment in the Fenway area, very small. It was just a lot of us to be living in the apartment. We slept in the floor. It was an experience that I never had before. And my dad, he got very sick and went through a surgery. And because he was so sick, he needed to be in a place that was going to be sanitized and that had enough space for him to be in after the hospital. And my grandma's house was just too small for that. Sometimes in the morning, we will wake up and by accident, I step on my dad because I was trying to reach my uniform for school. And after that, like, my dad decided that we needed to go to a shelter because he was not getting employment since he was new to the U.S. and he hadn't even started working yet. And he decided to go to a shelter with us. At first, we got rejected, and it was very sad, and we just got through it because my dad was able to go for a second time, and he got a letter from the hospital saying that the place where he was living, it wasn't in good condition, so we needed a place to stay. And then he still got rejected the second time, which is sad. And the third time,
Wait, what was the reason they gave for rejecting him?
They just said that they didn't have enough space for us.
Okay, yep.
For a family of three. So the third time, my dad decided that he wanted us to take our luggage and put all of our belongings in the luggages. And we woke up about 4 a.m. and we decided to go to the place. And we were there like first thing in the morning with our luggages, basically homeless. My dad had already about three doctor's letters saying that he couldn't be in my grandma's house because it wasn't healthy for him to be there. And that's when they decided to take us into the program. I remember that day they decided to put us in a transportation and they could transport us to Malden. Malden for me was very sad. It was just, I always been around people. The DR were always outside. Here in Boston, I was always outside in parks. But Malden was just very, sad. The place where we were, it was just shelters. And nobody would, say hi to us. And the place that we were, there was not... we didn't have a real stove. We only had microwave and a tub, but it wasn't clean. It was just very sad. And I started crying and I didn't eat for 24 hours. I started calling my mom and saying that I wanted to go back home, that I was struggling. And that's when my dad had to call the social worker, and he said that I hadn't eaten anything for 24 hours and that I'm not doing good. I'm just too far from home. I can't even see my grandma. And that day, they came and picked us up. So the next day, they came and picked us up, and they brought us to a house in Dorchester close to Ashland. When we got there, I felt relieved. I felt happy. But I didn't know that it was just the beginning. It was just the beginning of everything that I was going to go through. So we got there. We got new furniture. at least, like, I call it furnished, like a new bed. I had a bed that wasn't just laying on the floor. We had kitchen utensils. And the first thing they said was not to get too comfortable. And what they meant by that was not to have, they didn't want us to fix the house to an extent where we felt like it was actually our home, because we'll be moving out of there in less than a year, which it was not true. Then winter arrived. It was winter time. It was the worst experience ever. We didn't have heat in the house. The house Wow. didn't have heat.
Was that a shelter? Dad, was that a shelter provided by the state there in Dorchester?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. The house didn't have heat. The only bus that would go through the house, and not through the house, that would leave us like maybe three streets down, it was a 23 bus, and it would pass like every 40 minutes. And it was just like very far from everything. We didn't have heat. The house wasn't the best, like, maintenance, I would say. We did have neighbors, and they would talk to us, and we would like try to have a conversation with them because we felt lonely in there. It was just us. I had to learn how to cook. I had to learn how to clean. I had to learn how to help my brothers in situations that they couldn't help themselves.
Right.
It was just a lot, but we got through it.
Yeah, so what was it like for you, you know, having daily responsibilities like going to school, but you were still living in shelter? Like, what were the hardest parts of that experience for you?
I would say that the hardest part was the commute to school. It was about an hour and maybe 20 minutes in total.
That's a long time, yeah.
Yeah, it was a long time. And I was just in middle school, and we had what's called Charlie cards. And back then, if you had a Charlie card, it wasn't like the M7, which is the bus pass that you get unlimited ride on the bus for free. This was an S card that you get charged every time you tap into the bus. But because my dad, he wasn't working, so that means that we didn't have enough income in the house. It was hard for me to commute because most of the time I used to get left out by bus drivers because I didn't have the fare to pay. And I'll get late to school.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I get so emotional.
No, it's okay. It's okay. It's real. And you'd have to wait for a bus driver who would pick you up.
And, yes, I would just wait a few more minutes until the next bus driver would come. And I was hoping for the bus driver to be a good person and to let me in for free. But I would never tell my dad that I was going through that.
Wow.
Because I didn't want to upset him.
Yeah.
I used to tell my dad that I was getting to school on time until I got caught. The principal started calling home, and my dad started finding out that I was getting into school, and that the reason was because I used to get up early but couldn't make it to the bus on time. Or I would make it to the bus on time, but I couldn't pay for the bus ride. And I would get left out in the winter in the summer, in the spring, it didn't matter. And that's when my dad started to take us. He was able to help my brother and I sometimes to take us close to the station, where we just had to either walk to school or take another bus. But most of the time, he would give us 75 cents to get in. But still, I didn't want him to know because he couldn't afford it. 75 cents right now, it's like, what, you find it in the streets? For us, it was not like that.
Yeah.
So I think that the hardest part was the commute.
And so how long was it until you and your family got into a permanent apartment?
It was about almost 2 years. I would say a year and 8 months until we were able to find a house and move all together. They kept saying, like, the social worker kept saying that we were going to have our own apartment by 9 months, a year. And we were just there winter, spring, the fall, in the same house, and nothing will happen until my dad decided to see if it was a social worker that didn't want to help us. And he changed the person that was helping us at first. And after that, we were able to get our voucher and move to our current house.
Do you think that there should be, based on the experience you had as a kid in that situation, do you think we should try to pass laws to prevent any child from ever spending time in a homeless shelter or, you know, without a home like you did? Like, what do you think are the biggest risks for kids who have to grow up in an insecure housing situation?
I do. I agree. I believe there should be something that wouldn't allow kids to be in shelter for so long, because we grow up insecure. We grow up questioning ourselves when we're next to people that are even in the same school as us. And I feel like the shelter has a lot to do with me feeling insecure when I'm next to a person that is also going to suffer just like me, which means that they have the same education as me. That means that they are as smart as me. I still feel like I'm not as worth it as they are, because I went through this process and they are always in for like really good education. They're always they get to be loved by like their family at all times, because their family maybe work, but maybe one parent stay home. And I didn't have that. My parent had to go to work after he recovered from his surgery. He has to go to work, and I used to see my dad at night. So I do think that there should be a program for kids not to experience this. I feel like it's the worst. It makes us grow faster than we want to, because we don't have a choice. But I also feel like that takes away a lot of our like child innocence. It makes you grow even if you don't want to.
Okay. That's a thoughtful answer. Thank you. Let's pretend that we know this episode is going to be heard by some young kids who are currently facing a family eviction or living in a homeless shelter. What advice can you give them as someone who's lived through it? And in your case, you landed on your feet. You know, you've got a good job. You're in college full time with a full scholarship, I've got to add. And you've got a really bright future ahead of you. Like, what's a piece of advice that you could give a kid living in shelter who heard your words?
I would just like for them to know that always remember that everyone is just as important as you. nobody is more important than you are. It might seem like the world is coming for you and everything is going bad, but that saying about you first have to go through bad times in order to enjoy good times is true. At some point, when you are in a shelter, you just feel like you are depressed, and that's not going to last a long time. It's after you get a home and you are able to be with your family, you feel that relief in your heart, and you're just going to be great. I just have to say, to keep up with school, never ever leave school. Always try your hardest. Always seek for help. I always find Guardian Angel. That's how I call the people that help me. For me, you, Mr. Donahue, you are a Guardian Angel for me. And I have a few in my life, which I'm very grateful. There is a lot of good people out there that want to help you. And if you let them help you, you're going to do great. Don't give up. Help your parents. Don't be rude to your parents. Just follow all the advice other people have to say. And you would, the good advice, and you will do great.
That's really uplifting. I love that message. And kind of look out for those guardian angels, right? The people who are ready to help you. So I don't want to keep you any longer. I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your experience and also your message of hope. I'm really so proud of you, Francesca. You didn't listen to people at your high school who told you to settle for less in terms of what colleges you should apply to. I'd love to have you back on the show some later date to talk about another issue, because you've got a bunch of things that you care about and that you can speak about. But in the meantime, keep taking such good care of your friends and family. Take good care of yourself. Cuídate, Francesca.
Muchas gracias.
Welcome to Trickle Down Socialism, Tim.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So Tim Scalona is a public policy graduate student at UMass Amherst. He wrote two letters, and I want to commend you for that work, Tim. They were both really well-written letters. First letter was written and published in March, asking what would happen to homeless students when colleges closed. And the second was published this month about what the state and federal government could do to prevent massive numbers of evictions. What compelled you to write these two letters, Tim?
There's really a lot for me that led up to the point that I was able to write for the Boston Globe. I've been a student at UMass for over four years now, because I graduated my undergrad in May. Before that, I spent my college experience organizing around college affordability, housing security, healthcare, in combination with organizing around the election seasons that was 2016, 2018, and now 2020. And the experiences that came with organizing on those, on the state level, the federal level, as well as on my own campus, around specifically trying to get the college administrators in the state to better fund education or to provide more affordable housing for low-income persons between different localities, is really informed by the fact that I was and am a first-generation, low-income, previously homeless college student. I have a lot of different privileges as I am a student that I see with my siblings. I have six younger siblings, and they're all still living in a homeless shelter right now, or they were last that I remember. I haven't been there in a few years because the environment is a very traumatizing environment to live in. And we've lived in flux between hotels and shelters and apartments for 7 or 8 years now. So in light of these experiences, I've been trying to humanize the experience of what it means to be someone from that background, not so as to represent it, but to bring light to issues that sometimes people miss within these communities, and eviction and the experience of students that are homeless or were homeless is not so much talked about in major media sources.
You're absolutely right about that. That brings me to my next question, which is, at the start of your July piece, you kind of really personalized the experience of eviction. You started off with a paragraph that was really compelling about your experience getting evicted. Could you tell us briefly how that experience kind of shapes you today?
I would say that it is both a motivator for me as well as it is a center of trauma. The beginning of that article, I focus on the fact that I still have this image in my head of my home that was the centerpiece of my childhood for so long. I still can picture the, like, its sun-stained exterior, the shed that we had in our backyard, our fire pit. We lived in a cul-de-sac. I came from middle-class privilege, at least for the beginning of my life. But I look at that period and I look at that house and I long for what it was before. But as I get older, I'm sort of losing those happy memories because I increasingly am familiar with the impact that the foreclosure had on me and my family, seeing the lead up to it, in which I was in eighth grade at the time, so I wasn't exactly aware of what was going on, but my parents were aware. You could tell that there was increased conflict and tension on our household as we approached our foreclosure date. I was there when the mortgage company came to auction off our home while I was there because I was home from school. That was like the first moment that I remember being threatened with the idea of homelessness. And then the actual foreclosure date, when the sheriff came to the door and made us leave, my mom was very distraught. My siblings were distraught. We couldn't bring all of our belongings, so we had to leave a ton in our basement. Photo albums, toys, furniture. And it then led into this very traumatic hotel and shelter transition where we had limited money, limited income, and our experience was diminished and we didn't have community support. So, like, what was a, like, point of trauma for me, and still is, has now informed everything that I'm doing, because I see something like that and I feel the impact of the eviction, and it still is impacting me to this day in my own mental state, and the extent that I feel safe in my surroundings, the extent that I unpack my rooms and places that I moved to, because for so long we had lived between put our belongings in cardboard boxes when I was living in this environment in high school. So it is both a point of trauma, but it also is then also motivating me to bring light to this, because you have people that are talking about the effect of eviction as if it is a financial statistic, as if all these landlords are not going to be able to pay their bills because their tenants aren't paying them rent, without actually taking into account the fact that if these landlords are to evict these people, the impact of that, what it's going to do, because even 7-8 years later, I still very strongly remember how it felt to be kicked out of a place that I thought was the safest place that I could have ever been in.
Thank you for going into such detail there. I think that people really do need to take into account the personal effect that it causes, you know, on every person who goes through that experience. The main point, as I see it in your July op-ed, is that we need much more robust policies in place to prevent an eviction crisis. The state legislature did push back the moratorium on evictions another 2 months, but you mentioned that a year-long ban from the end of the state of emergency would make more sense. But what else?
Yeah, there needs to be more concrete policy solutions put into place. And right now, the moratorium in particular, which is a very necessary policy, but it is a lower tier one in my opinion, that is already being challenged by very powerful landlord lobbying groups. But regardless, if the legislator is to commit to supporting tenants and to truly try to prevent homelessness in this way, they need to further invest in RAFT, which is the Residential Assistance for Families in Transition program. This provides emergency rental assistance to families who meet qualifying income conditions. Additionally, they need to invest in the Emergency Assistance Program, which is the statewide family emergency shelter system, and best invest in affordable housing structures. And beyond that investment, what could prevent this entirely, in my opinion, which was a bit controversial for me to bring up at all, because I haven't heard it mentioned so much, was the idea of a rent and a mortgage freeze. Because even with a moratorium that ends after the state of emergency ends, there is still going to be people that are going to have months worth of back pay rents, that then is going to cause them to be evicted. At least in my opinion, there are not enough jobs today that, or if any, that pay people living wage currently, exacerbated by COVID-19, which are going to allow them to pay back that much rent. So in my opinion, there needs to be both these more preventative measures, investments in rental assistance and emergency shelter. But long term, we need to couple a moratorium with a rent and a mortgage freeze to also allow people the financial stability and housing stability once the moratorium ends, so that it doesn't cause an influx of evictions just a year down the line.
Right, because once this people do get back on their feet, that back rent is going to be a barrier for way too many families. So now you've mentioned your personal psychological trauma that stays with you, and you laid out some of the other risks that we face. Why is this such an urgent cause that needs to be taken seriously?
I so often hear people say that, at least within the past 4 years, within the age of Trump, that we're fighting, as the Biden campaign says, that we're fighting for the soul of our nation. And I have frequently taken issue with that kind of rhetoric because I feel like the system isn't broken. It is working as it was intended to do, which it was intended to function as a racist and classist political system. So what's at stake here is COVID-19 is revealing and exacerbating all these institutional inequalities that have already existed and making them so much worse. In regards to evictions in the state of Massachusetts, granted this isn't on a federal level. I would love if there was a federal housing guarantee or some universal right to public housing. But what is definitely at stake here is the lives of children and families and individuals who are so commonly pushed under the margins of society. And we're fighting for a future where children and families don't have to be in a situation, don't have to be put into homelessness, and don't have to think 10 years post-eviction or foreclosure, still be suffering from the trauma of such an event. But we have the opportunity, in light of the institutional inequities that COVID-19 is revealing, to create a more robust, affordable public housing system that not only prevents homelessness, but questions why that it is a acceptable concept in people's frame of mind.
Yeah, I really appreciate that point you just made. I think you're hitting it right on the head in terms of like what our show is about as well. Is you know, we put this show together to try to expose those types of flaws in the system and to explore policies that would make more sense and create a government that works for everyone. Tim, I appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. I wish you the best of luck as you continue studying public policy and also as you continue organizing and agitating and pushing for change that I think will benefit all of us. So thanks so much, Tim, for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. I love these kinds of podcasts.
Great. Thanks, Tim.